Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Jeff Shara, who reads from and discusses his new book, The Rising Tide, published by Ballantine. In the weeks to come, we have Les Claypool, Jerry Spence, Jim Lair, Nick Bantock, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Publishers Weekly is one of the most highly regarded trade periodicals in the book-selling industry, and it's only the best of the best that are awarded the coveted starred review from Publishers Weekly. So by way of introduction this evening, I'd like to share with you the starred review of The Rising Tide. Jeff Shara, who has written best-selling and critically acclaimed historical novels covering the American Revolution through World War I, takes on World War II in the wonderful first volume of a planned trilogy. As the book begins, Hitler's forces control Western Europe and U.S. troops face off against the Germans in North Africa. From fall 1942 through spring 1943, the Allies battle Field Marshal Erwin Rommel's Africa Corps. Shara evokes the agony of desert warfare and the utter chaos of an airborne assault through the experiences of Private Jack Logan, a tank gunner, and Sergeant Jesse Adams, a paratrooper. The challenges and frequent frustrations of command are seen through the eyes of such luminaries as Generals Dwight Eisenhower, George Patton, and Rommel. The Allied victory in Africa is followed by the conquest of Sicily and the invasion of mainland Italy in 1943. With the Italian campaign sputtering, the Allies turn to planning for the decisive event of the European theater, the cross-channel invasion of France, which is where Shara concludes this sprawling, masterful opening act. We're delighted that Jeff Shara has returned to the Tattered Cover this evening on the day that he has found out that he has returned to the New York Times bestseller list to present his new book, The Rising Tide. Would you please welcome Jeff?
At the risk of sounding like I'm completely promoting myself, of course, I guess that's what I'm doing here, is completely promoting myself. In fact, at 5 o'clock this afternoon, I got a very bizarre voice message on my cell phone. It was my publicist and my editor in New York singing together in discordantly into my cell phone, congratulations at number 8 on the New York Times list. So that blows me away. There's a lot of big writers and good writers with big books out there right now, and I didn't really expect for this to happen. That's not false modesty. It's marketing. It's business, but it's a good thing. What I'd like to do, first of all, you may notice I don't have notes. I didn't bring something to read to you, a speech. I didn't come here to give a speech. I don't think you came here to hear one. What I do is I like to just talk to you a little bit about this and about the process and you know how this came about and what some of the pitfalls were and some of my anxiety about it, and then also do a very, very, and I'm paranoid about this, a very brief reading. As I've said many times, there's nothing worse than an author who loves the sound of his own voice, and you know, I don't care who the author is, I don't care if it's Stephen King or J.K. Rowling, if they read 20 pages to you, you're going to sleep, and I mean, I'm very aware of that, and there's nothing also worse than an author who loves the sound of their own voice, and I don't, but I would like to do a very brief, just a little piece of this, just to show you, if you're not familiar, just to show you maybe a little piece of what I do. And then question and answer from you. I mean, that's what I enjoy, finding what's on your mind. And we'll talk about anything. The advantage in not having a prepared text is that I'm liable to talk about anything, and we can go in any direction you want. The disadvantage of not having prepared text is that I'm liable to talk about anything. I really can't ever start talking about anything I do without first mentioning the art of storytelling. I'm not an historian. Those of you who know anything about me or know what I do know that I did not begin this, you know, in a vacuum, that this started with my father. Michael Shara was a writer all his life. Started out as a sci-fi writer in the early 50s, published 70 short stories in every major magazine of the day in the 50s and 60s, wrote a lot of police drama, that sort of thing. He wrote a book called The Broken Place, which is a sort of a Korean War prize fighter story that nobody read. And he got obsessed with telling the story of the Battle of Gettysburg. Now, he had no background in history at all. He wasn't a Civil War guy. But we went to Gettysburg. I was 12. And we went to Gettysburg, and we have, you know, eight millimeter movies of me climbing all over cannons, you know, which is what 12-year-olds do. What I didn't understand at the time is that walking the ground at Gettysburg affected him in a very profound way. He knew a good story when he saw one. And that really started an obsession with him in creating a book which was called The Killer Angels. The Killer Angels came out in 1974, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1975, and was a dismal's too strong. It was never a commercially successful book in my father's lifetime, which surprises a lot of people. If you were a Civil War buff, if you were in the military, went to West Point, you'd heard of The Killer Angels. It was required reading. Otherwise, most people never heard of it. That was an enormous, crushing disappointment to my father. Man wins a Pulitzer Prize. He has every right to expect all the doors fly open in New York. He can do anything he wants to. Whatever he writes, there's going to be a publisher. In fact, that never happened to Michael Shara. Well, growing up in the house of a writer as a kid, one of the things, the technique that my father used in writing his stories, all his stories, was to talk about them first. And I didn't really understand that it was technique. I'm a kid. I'm sitting around the dinner table, my sister, my mother, and my father would tell us the story, a story, any story. You know, it's a science fiction, whatever, story of mapping command, which was sort of the theme he followed all through his science fiction stories, these guys who were smoking cigarettes in the cockpit. I mean, it's real dated stuff. But then he began to talk about Joshua Chamberlain, a little round top. And Louis Armistead, with his hat on his sword, as he's leading the Confederates across the ground, Pickett's charge. And, I mean, I'm the kid, and I'm watching my old man tell these stories, and my mouth is hanging open, because he was first and foremost a storyteller. Now, when I began to do this, and I stumbled into this in a very odd way, and some of you have probably heard me talk about this, but the film Gettysburg came out in 1993. Gettysburg, based on The Killer Angels, made The Killer Angels a number one bestseller 19 years after it was published. I don't know that that's ever happened before. Gettysburg was, when it aired on TNT the first time, it was watched by 33 million people. That was the largest, highest rated cable show ever up to that time. My father passed away in 1988, 5 years before. He did not live to see any of that. Well, after the wonderful success of Gettysburg and The Killer Angels is now a number one bestseller, I get a phone call saying, you know, Ted Turner wants to do this again. You know, Ted Turner put up the money, took an enormous risk. It was called Ted's Folly at TNT, that he wanted to make a film out of The Killer Angels. Who cares about the Civil War? There's a lot of that stuff. Well, I heard Ted Turner wants to make more movies. Wouldn't it be wonderful to take your father's book and go before and after and tell the story of these same characters? Because The Killer Angels covers 4 days around the Battle of Gettysburg. Well, there's a lot of stuff in the Civil War that Killer Angels does not touch, a lot of characters. I thought about it for a while and thought, you know, maybe this is something I'd like to try to do. And that was a difficult decision because I'd never written anything before, and that's not false modesty. I had never written anything. I was a dealer in rare coins and precious metals in Tampa, Florida. Did that, and I had a degree in criminology from Florida State. I'd never, growing up in the house of a writer who had a tough career, who struggled with writer's block, who struggled with rejection letters. The Killer Angels was turned down by the first 15 publishers who saw it. That was my father's life. That was not my life. I didn't want to do that. So I'm a businessman, and I thought about it, and I knew, what is it that made The Killer Angels work? What's the magic of that book? And the magic is it's not a history book. It's not what you read in high school. It's not all about names, dates, places, facts, and figures. It's the story of the people, what my father did for the first time. I mean, there's lots of historical fiction. The setting usually is real, an historical setting, but the characters are fictitious. And there's lots of that. I mean, the Red Badge of Courage, I mean, on and on. That's what historical fiction usually is. What my father did is he took you to Gettysburg and he put you in the heads of the real people. Robert E. Lee and James Longstreet, General John Buford, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. You are seeing what happens through their eyes, from their points of view. Nobody had ever really done that before. So I knew if I'm going to do this, if I dare to do this, I better, you know, do my father's research. All the research, diaries, letters, memoirs. My father was quoted, said to a newspaper reporter when he was working on the Killer Angels that during that process he was visited by every character in his story. That's not a good thing to say to a newspaper reporter. It sort of comes out Michael Schara's a schizophrenic. I know exactly what he meant. Because what I had to do was, who is Robert E. Lee? Somebody said to me in Virginia, how dare you put words in the mouth of Robert E. Lee? Okay, I take that very seriously. If I dare to put words in the mouth of Robert E. Lee or George Washington or Benjamin Franklin or Black Jack Pershing, I had better believe that those words are at least authentic. If I don't believe it, you won't believe it, and the story simply won't work. Well, how do you do that? Hear their voices. You know, be visited. Visit them. Hope they visit me back. You know, go back, read their letters. Not all these guys wrote memoirs. I mean, Robert E. Lee didn't write memoirs. George Washington didn't. In fact, Martha Washington burned his letters. You know, when after his death, it's nobody's business. Fortunately for us, anybody who cares about the American Revolution, John and Abigail Adams, they didn't burn their letters. John Quincy Adams, their son, sixth president of the United States, was responsible for sort of shepherding all their material, passing it down. We have their letters. We know what, it was a romance, a wonderful story, but we know what they were going through. They did not expect that 240 years later, you know, we're going to be reading their letters. Diaries. What is more honest than a diary? Any of you who've ever kept a diary or a personal journal, what are you going to do, lie to yourself? No, you're going to tell the truth. This is what you really think. This is what you're really feeling. When you get that kind of material, and there's a fair amount of it out there, that's the truth. That's what these characters are going through. That was my journey. Find that stuff. New characters, Stonewall Jackson, marvelous, marvelous stuff. Walk in the footsteps of the characters. The lesson from walking the ground at Gettysburg, go to these places. Walk in the footsteps of the characters, their graves, their homes, anything I can do. It's awfully convenient if I'm going to describe for you a hill that a bunch of guys run up. Don't you think it makes a lot of sense that I've seen the same hill, or maybe I've climbed the hill? I think that makes it a little bit better way to tell the story. Well, those were all the lessons. When my first book came out, Gods and Generals, it debuted on the New York Times bestseller list. I'm under no illusions that Gods and Generals could have been published with blank pages, and people would have bought it. Why? They wanted more of the Killer Angels. They wanted more of my father's story. I got huge benefit of the doubt from the critics. I mean, my sister said to me, all right, you better get ready, because every single review is going to start, well, it's no Killer Angels. Oh, yeah, I was ready for that. And I got a fair amount of that. I got one review from a guy, and I don't remember, it was in Texas, Austin or Fort Worth or something, and the guy said, so what did this guy Jeff Schara do? Find a manuscript in his father's effects and slap his own name on it? Now, that wasn't a very nice thing to say, but in fact, what the man was saying, and he didn't mean to, what he was saying was Gods and Generals could have been written by Michael Schara. What a compliment. I mean, I was amazed by that. And then I started getting reviews saying, you know, this book actually could sit on the same shelf. Wow. I mean, that was as nice a thing as anybody could say to me. There were others that said, you know, squeezing the last dime from the Michael Schara estate. You know, there were a few of those. I tried not to look at those. But now I'm a writer. I mean, now I've got a publisher saying, you know, you done with the next one? My whole life changed with that in that process, but the lessons didn't. And going through, I mentioned briefly, the American Revolution, you know, exploring the character, how dare I put words in the mouth of Ben Franklin, who to me is the most important American who ever lived, maybe. I mean, and that sounds like an exaggeration, but maybe it's not. The question I've gotten a lot, which character in all your stories would you most like, the way somebody put it, would you most like to have lunch with? Benjamin Franklin. This is the man that changed the history of the world. You know, this is the man who seduced King Louis in France to come into the American Revolution to send French soldiers on our side. Had he not, we would have lost. We would have lost the American Revolution. The man changed the history of the world. How dare I put words in this guy's mouth? Well, that's part of the adventure of this. Who is this character? All the way through this process, through the Civil War, the American Revolution, the First World War, when I learned, I didn't know anything about the First World War. Chances are most of you didn't learn much either, unless you purposely studied it. You're not taught anything in school about the First World War. Hollywood gives us, I mean, I can count on one hand the good movies on the First World War. Sergeant York, you know, Gary Cooper wins an Oscar in about 1940 or whenever it was. Gallipoli, maybe. Paths of Glory, Kirk Douglas, All Quiet on the Western Front. Then, like, pause. I mean, there's not much else. Well, I got excited by that. I like telling you a story that's a surprise. I was amazed, and I said it when I was in Denver 2 years ago when To the Last Man came out, the book on the First World War. I'd gone around the country and I was talking about the Red Baron. You know, well, we've heard of the Red Baron, sure. You know, Manfred von Richthofen, guy flies the red plane with the three wings. I was amazed how many people thought the Red Baron was a cartoon character. And that's a sad commentary on how we're taught history in school, but it's a sad commentary on how much we know about the First World War. This man is the finest flying ace in World War I, and most people have no idea. That got me excited. Most people, even fewer people, have ever heard of the Lafayette Escadrille. If you went to see the movie Flyboys about 6 weeks ago that, you know, came and went in theaters quickly, thank goodness, you didn't learn much more there either. But in fact, the Lafayette Escadrille, all these American pilots who go to France illegally to fly for the French, marvelous story. I knew nothing. I got excited about that. That's what I want to do. I'm going to bring you a story you don't know. I start talking to my publisher. I want to do Korea. I was here 2 years ago, everywhere around the country. I'm on C-SPAN. I mean, like, it's public record. I've been quoted as saying, the next book I'm doing is Korea. I got a zillion emails through my website from Korean war vets. They're sending me stuff. You know, I have a diary, I have a memoir. I'm an honorary member of the Chosin Few. The Chosin Few are the Marines who survived the Chosin Reservoir in Korea. I mean, it was the coldest, most horrifying winter in that part of the world in decades, and Marines are freezing to death. I mean, it's a horrible story. The survivors, they take that very seriously, and they're a very tight-knit group, and I wrote them a nice letter, and I got this medal back, and I'm an honorary member because they want me to tell their story, and I want to tell their story because you don't know the story. Well, that's going to have to wait a little while. I am going to tell the story. But I start talking to my publisher, and they're saying, you know, you left us hanging with your book on World War I, because at the end, what do? You mention Adolf Hitler. Well, that's sort of like, you know, pause. It's like the cliffhanger on TV shows. I thought about that. Yeah, but what can I possibly add to World War II that you don't know? I mean, how much stuff is out there about World War II? First of all, in school, you know, in the high school history textbook, there's lots of stuff in there. Hollywood has shaped and framed our knowledge of World War II. John Wayne alone has given us, I mean, you're about the Marines in the Pacific, you know, Back to Bataan and all these movies. You know, we know lots of stuff about the World War II. If I start mentioning to you the cast of characters, Patton, Rommel, Montgomery, Eisenhower, Hitler, Mussolini, Roosevelt, Churchill, you know, we know who those guys are. I started looking at this story thinking, I don't think this is going to work. I started looking at the story and I realized, ooh, first of all, George Patton. You know, we don't know George. I'll tell you what we know about George Patton. We know George C. Scott. I'm going to take nothing away from George C. Scott. I love the man as an actor. Won an Academy Award for his portrayal of Patton. But that's what we know about Patton. It's a little bit of a different story. I'm going to get grief from Patton fans. I am not about cutting the man to pieces. This isn't revisionist history. I have Patton's diary. I know what he thought about Eisenhower because he tells his diary. You know, his disrespect for the people around him is really pretty intense. And Patton is a man who easily makes enemies. And, you know, taking nothing away from his heroism, the fact that this man's probably one of the finest battlefield commanders, that's the operative word, battlefield. He wants to be out there. Back there where the plans are being made and the strategies, and you have to get along with each other, and the British and the Americans are trying desperately to do this with their two armies and put them together, Patton's miserable at that. But you know who's not miserable at it? It's Eisenhower. Eisenhower, most of us, what we know about Eisenhower, he's president in the 50s. You know, he gave us the interstate highway system. Eisenhower, you know, the 50s, the cliche, the dull decade, the boring, no, nothing happens, the most conservative decade. Eisenhower is the guy who's always photographed playing golf. You know, he smokes a lot of cigarettes. That's mostly what we know about Eisenhower. Let me tell you something. Eisenhower is as important to the Second World War as Benjamin Franklin or George Washington are important to the American Revolution. Dwight Eisenhower won the war in Europe. And I've been saying this a couple times, I've only been on the road for a week now, but I've been saying this a couple times, and I'm waiting for some historian to get up and, you know, tell me I'm wrong. Go ahead, because I've got the evidence. I mean, I've got the documentation. What Eisenhower does, he takes the American Army, Navy, Air Force, the British Army, Navy, Air Force, and he puts them together in one army, one navy, one air force. That's never been done. I mean, these guys don't particularly like each other. They've got different ways of doing things. The armies, the British have already been fighting. They've already gotten their butts kicked right off the European continent at Dunkirk. I mean, they almost were massacred at Dunkirk, and they escaped. Now, you've heard the story of Dunkirk, 250,000 British troops on the beach. Everything that can float in England is sent across the channel. I mean, fishing boats, tugboats, everything, pleasure craft, picking these guys up. You know, the Luftwaffe overhead is bombing and strafing. They rescue 250,000 British soldiers off the beach at Dunkirk. If that hadn't happened, the whole war would have changed. But the British Army, I mean, they've had their experience. We're brand spanking new. We don't know anything. America's brought into the war how? Pearl Harbor. Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, an idiotic mistake, because suddenly all the people in the United States who don't want to be in the war, there are a lot of people that said, that's Europe's problem. We don't want it to be anything to do with that. Celebrities in this country in the 30s. Charles Lindbergh, enormous celebrity in this country, pro-German. We have no business getting in a war fighting the Germans. Now, that's a pretty loud public voice. Newspapers, a lot of congressmen. Pearl Harbor happens, all those people shut up. Nothing else they can say. We're in the war. Now we've got an army who doesn't have a clue. We've got tanks. We're pumping out tanks. Well, first of all, one of the things we do have in this country is the ability to adapt. And all of a sudden, the factories, the industrial strength of this country turns from making sewing machines and washing machines, all these different things. Suddenly we start making tanks and machine guns. I mean, we do this fairly quickly. The people, the citizens of the United States go on rationing. Gasoline, you know, you can't have all the gasoline you want. You can have this much. You know, you get coupons. You know, you can have this much bread and this much cooking oil. And I mean, all of these kind of things are rationed because we need the stuff for the war effort. Enormous energy is put toward this. But still, our soldiers, they have not fought anybody. We go to North Africa, and here's the question. When I start talking about North Africa, who cares about North Africa? Well, first of all, why were they even fighting in North Africa? I mean, it's, you know, there's nothing there. Rommel, the German general, goes to North Africa fighting the British. There's two good reasons. The British hold Egypt. In Egypt, the Suez Canal. That's crucial to shipping. The Germans want the Suez Canal. Beyond the Suez Canal, going east, what's there? The Middle East. What's in the Middle East? Oil. The Germans want the oil. Germany has already invaded Russia. If Hitler is fighting this monstrous war in Russia, if Rommel can come up, from my perspective, if Rommel can come up through the Middle East and link his army in the Ukraine, solid front, I mean, it's, you know, all that oil in the Middle East can feed Hitler's war machine in Russia. There's all these good reasons that's how North Africa happens. Plus, you've got this one other little thing, Mussolini, dictator of Italy, who's Hitler's ally, he wants to turn North Africa into the new Roman Empire. That's Mussolini's dream, is to, you know, reconquer all that land that the Romans conquered and make his own, you know, with him as Caesar, make his own Roman Empire. Well, Rommel didn't want to listen to all that. He's got better things to do, which is fight a war. Erwin Rommel, when I started researching Rommel, I got really nervous because this man, I mean, he's a German. He's the bad guy. How do I paint a portrayal of Rommel that's the least bit positive without getting just slammed for it? You know, the man's a Nazi, he's this, he's that. No, he's not. He's not a Nazi. He never joins the Nazi party. He is a career soldier. He's a German hero in the First World War. He wins the Blue Max, which is Germany's highest military honor in the First World War. He's a legitimate hero. He's a career officer. A lot of the German military, these guys have been officers all their lives. That's what they do. They're professional soldiers. They're not really sure about Hitler. They don't really like all that screaming into microphones all over Germany. What Hitler's doing is he's talking to the civilians. He's not talking to the army. But what Hitler does for the army, I'll back up. The Treaty of Versailles in 1919 denudes the German army. You can only have 100,000 men, no tanks, no submarines, no airplanes, no large-scale artillery. The German army is crippled. Well, they're not real happy about that. What Hitler says is, takes the Treaty of Versailles, throws it out the window, says, you do whatever you want. Here's a whole bunch of money, the factories, the German army begins to rebuild itself. Well, for the soldiers, that's a good thing. The officers can begin to ply their trade again. They're listening to all this stuff Hitler's saying, and well, yeah, but you know, he's given us our army back. And I'm not excusing anybody, and don't assume that I'm pro-Nazi, please. I'm going to get letters, I know. There's nothing I can do about that. But Rommel is very, very good at what he does. That appeals to me right off the bat. I don't care who you are. I don't care what army you fight for or what war you're in. People who are very good at what they do, chances are there's a good story there. That's what I tried to find with the character of Rommel. Now, you know, I'm talking about all the head guys. I talk about Eisenhower and Patton, all these different people. They're all at the top. What I learned in my last book, when I started dealing with the world, with World War I, all my books prior to that are told from the top down, you know, the generals. The more modern you go, the farther the generals are from the front lines. So to tell, I mean, Stonewall Jackson, yeah, I mean, Stonewall Jackson is shot. Why? He's riding in between. Not only is he on the front lines, he's between the front lines. He's in front of his front lines. That doesn't work in the 20th century. So I needed, if I'm going to write a story that's going to make any sense, I need to find, you know, somebody out there, somebody in the stuff. Well, in my book on the First World War, To the Last Man, I found a Marine, 19-year-old Marine, Roscoe Temple, wonderful character. I got a lot of letters from Marines. Real happy about that. Any Marines here? I made a deadly mistake. I asked an audience if there were any ex-Marines. As you well know, there is no such thing. Well, when I started working on this story, I'm in, you know, the European theater, and I already have gotten emails through my website from Marines saying, hey, we're not in Europe. We're in the Pacific. You know, don't forget about us. Well, okay, calm down. I actually intend to do that. I intend to go to the Pacific after this trilogy is done, finish the war. Whoa, I mean, you talk about some drama. You know, the dropping of the bomb, what's more dramatic in the 20th century than that? Well, I needed somebody out there, a grunt or two. I found a tank gunner, 24-year-old from St. Petersburg, Florida, named Jack Logan. This is the guy who sits in the tank and fires the cannon. Now, what he's in, there's four guys in this tank crew. Now, I've been in a Stuart M3 light tank. That's what these guys drove in North Africa. I'm 6'1". I don't fit in a Stuart M3. I mean, my head, you know, it doesn't work. Four of them are in this tank. Jack Logan is the gunner. He's the man. He leans in. He's got these circular things that he leans against. He's got his gun sight. He's the guy who fires the cannon. He's got a 37-millimeter cannon. That's about like that. He goes to North Africa, and he confronts the campaign that's known now as Kasserine Pass. He confronts Germans in armor. The German tanks are roughly twice the size of the Stuart M3, and they have either a 75 or an 88 millimeter cannon. What Logan observes through his gun sight when he fires his 37-millimeter cannon at a German tank is the shell bounces off. That's probably not a good feeling. What happens to Jack Logan is a big part of this story. There's more to the story after North Africa, and that's Sicily. And again, who knows about Sicily? Most people, yeah, we invaded Sicily. Boy, is there a lot more to that story besides the race to Messina, which is from the George C. Scott, again, Patton and Montgomery. You know, who's going to get to Messina first? Well, there's a lot more to the story. We're going to invade Sicily. We're going to send American troops on the beach here, British troops on the beach here, and on Sicily there's a bunch of German tanks and a whole bunch of German and Italian soldiers, and we don't really know what we're going to be walking into, but we know one thing. If all those tanks and soldiers get to the beach to meet these guys coming off the boat, we're in a lot of trouble. A lot of these guys aren't going to make it. Our guys are not going to make it to the beach. What do? Let's send some paratroopers inland, let's drop them behind the German and Italian lines, do what they can, mischief, you know, cut the telegraph lines, burn the bridges, you know, make rain havoc, capture key intersections, you're not going to prevent or win the battle with the paratroopers, slow them down. Give the soldiers time to land on the beach, get their own tanks on the island, get the cannon on the island, and so forth. That's the whole idea. 3,400 paratroopers of the brand new 82nd Airborne Division. The 505th Paratroop Infantry Regiment leads this. 3,400 men, 18 men to a plane. These planes, those of you who know the old DC-3 passenger plane, that's a C-47 in World War II. That's what they're flying in. These guys, the night they're supposed to take off, oh, and by the way, night, not only are they going to jump out of an airplane into enemy territory in a place none of them have ever seen, they really don't have very good maps, there's Germans and Italians everywhere, we don't really know exactly where, so anywhere they jump, they're liable to jump right into somebody's backyard or their machine gun nest, but not only is that the disadvantage, we're going to do it at night. These guys are going to jump out of their airplane in the dark. I don't know how many of you have ever jumped out of an airplane. I haven't, but I don't think I'd want to do it. I mean, the joke is, why leave a perfectly good airplane in the dark and you can't see the ground and maybe somebody's shooting at you? That's pretty intense. Well, then, early in the evening, as Eisenhower is giving the final word for this to begin, a gale blows up in the Mediterranean. Paratroopers can jump safely up to 15-mile-an-hour wind. I mean, the planes can navigate and so forth, and, you know, guy coming down with a big parachute. 15-mile-an-hour wind's about it. There's a 35-mile-an-hour Force 5 gale blowing across Sicily. Eisenhower gives the order to go. Now, in fact, Jim Gavin, who's the commander of the 505th Parachute Infantry Regiment, they tell him about the 35-mile-an-hour winds as they're climbing on the planes, and his quote is, and this is a quote, and it's in the book, "What the hell am I supposed to do about it now?" There's nothing you can do about it. The problem, though, is that these 3,400 guys who are supposed to come down sort of here are scattered over 60 miles of the Sicilian countryside. So instead of hundreds of guys finding each other in the dark, you got ones and twos. Guys trying to find anyone they can. They have a call sign. I mean, you're in the dark. You land, you know, if you're lucky, your ankle isn't broken. You land, you hear some guy, you know, something rustling in the bushes. Well, what do you do? I mean, how do you find out if that's one of yours? They have a call sign. The United States Chief of Staff is George Marshall. That's the call sign. You say George. If the guy's one of yours, he says Marshall. That's how you find out. One of the guys jokes that, you know, why couldn't we've had a better call sign like Rita Hayworth, you know, but it's George Marshall. Well, of course, you say George, and the guy in the bushes, if the sound you hear is the bolt on a machine gun, he's probably not yours. That's what these guys have to confront. Now, this is what I would like to read to you, the character of Jesse Adams. Jesse Adams is a 21-year-old paratroop sergeant. This is a tough, tough man. He likes jumping out of airplanes. He doesn't mind doing it in the dark. But he's, you know, he's got his stick. The stick is the plane full of guys, 18 guys. His captain, Captain Schofield, Edwin Schofield, happens to be flying in the same plane with him, and the company commander. They get dropped into Sicily in the dark. And what I'd like to read to you, this is 2 pages. This is less than 5 minutes. I'm real paranoid about this. This is, you know, I don't want anybody sneaking out because they don't want to hear this. This is less than 5 minutes. I just want to read this little piece to you of what it is like when Josh Logan, when Jesse Logan, sorry, when Jesse Adams lands in Sicily in the dark. Adams lay still, his heart pounding hard, sorted through the pains, held tightly to the straps, pulled the parachute toward him, flattening it, slow, steady rhythm. He stayed on his back, could see streaks of white fire, the rattle of machine guns, no direction, no aim, they were everywhere. The parachute was flat now, and he slipped out of the harness, rolled away, pulled the Thompson from the straps behind his back, submachine gun. Felt the pockets, the heavy bulges, ammo clips, grenades, everything still where it was supposed to be. He rolled over to one side, eased a clip into the machine gun, slowly, pushing, the click making him flinch. He pulled the bolt back, held it, let it slide forward slowly, chambering around, the gun loaded, ready. The power of that rolling through him. Thank God, at least I can fight somebody. He rolled over to his back again, stared up, stars. The moon low on the horizon, sinking. The white streaks fewer now. He saw tree limbs, silhouetted to one side of him, thought, woods. All right, that's a good place to be. He rolled over to his knees, raised himself up, tried to see anything. Kept himself motionless, an animal, listening for prey, for any movement. The only sound, the quick, hard thumps in his ears, his own heart. The machine guns rattled on, but farther away now, much farther, no danger. And he looked toward the black woods, gripped the Thompson in his hand, touched the cloth bag of grenades again, began to move. The ground was grassy, and he was moving downhill, slow and steady, soft steps, eyes sharp, nothing to see, black trees, brush, and now a low wall. He stopped, squatted, peeked up over the wall, good cover, good place to sit. He listened again, no sounds. Felt a sudden burst of fear, anger at himself. Where the hell is everybody? He wanted to call out, what, something. Hell, the call sign. George. No, not yet. Krauts could be anywhere. Machine guns. He looked up, searched the sky, saw the Big Dipper, the edge of the cup pointing to the North Star. It was procedure that once they were on the ground, the last man in the stick would move in the opposite direction the plane had flown, the best way to find the others. And when we jumped, he thought, we were flying north. He leaned against the wall, tried to calm himself, slow his breathing. Good wall, thick rock. Damn it, can't stay here. Schofield, where the hell is Schofield? South of here, for sure. We couldn't be that far apart. Where the hell is everybody else? There were too many planes. Have to be guys all over the place. Somebody's got to be hurt. There's always somebody hurt. But keep quiet. No screaming. Not now. Not here. He heard sounds, a motor. Stared toward the noise, saw a glimpse of motion, reflection, a truck. The truck moved slowly past, no more than 50 yards away, no lights, low voices. He gripped the Thompson, froze, perfect stillness, good cover against the rock. Don't go shooting at anything, there could be 100 more. They're just looking around. They know we're out here. No searchlight, thank God. He was breathing heavily still, closed his eyes, clamped his arms close in tight, slow, easy, just find somebody. The truck was gone now. Silence. More gunfire, far in the distance. Now voices, behind him, beyond the wall. He froze again. The voices silent. One man, foreign. Meaningless words, soft-spoken, a whisper. Adams felt ice in his gut, sweating hands holding the Thompson. The grenades beneath him, unreachable, damn. There were footsteps close behind the wall, one man laughing, low, soft, another voice, angry, silencing the man. Adam stared at his own legs, realized one was extended, the wall barely 3 feet high, his boots reflecting moonlight like some bright, glistening light on the dark ground. Damn it, damn it. The footsteps still moved, past him now, moving away, and now another voice, beyond the wall, from the trees. George! The men at the wall stopped, silence, and Adams tried to see them in his mind, staring at the strange sound, pointing, silent commands. Adams was pulsing with anger, thought, no, you jackass, you stupid, who the hell, what the hell is the matter with you? Don't just call out. The footsteps moved away quickly, the rustle of grass, the men away from the wall. And Adams pulled his leg in close, one long, slow breath, pulled himself to his knees, raised up, peered over the wall. There was nothing. Black woods. Moonlight on gnarled trees. He could see the path now where the men had been, a wide track on the far side of the wall, a cart path. He waited, listened, nothing. Pulled himself up, stepped high, swung his legs over the wall, on the other side now. He dropped down again, strained to hear the voice again. George! He felt his insides turning over. No, no, damn you! And now another cry, the same voice, hey! And then the short, high scream. He stared at the sounds, the voices coming again, calling out foreign words, shadows emerging, four men coming onto the cart path, moonlight on rifles, helmets, the men a few yards away, moving off. He pointed to Thompson, thought, a quick burst, take them all. But there's another truck now on the road beyond the wall, coming fast, and he pulled the machine gun back close to his chest. No, don't be stupid. You'd have 100 of these bastards on you in no time. He stayed low, moved away from the wall, slipped into the tall grass, then passed, the ground hard and flat. The trees were around him, a low limb punching his helmet. Damn. He ducked, dropped to one knee. Moonlight, broken by the thick clusters of branches, realized an orchard, rows of trees. He moved farther in, where the sounds had been, soft steps. The Thompson pointed forward, saw a bright mass, moonlight on a parachute. The chute draped across the top of a tangled tree. He moved closer, could see the dark mass beneath it, the man hanging a few feet above the ground, silent, still. And Adams was there, put a hand on the man's boots, felt cold wetness, the hard smell of blood and urine, the smell of death. It's not quite how you read it in high school. That's not a happy story. War is not a happy story. If anything comes out of this, I hope what you'll understand is maybe there are things about this story that Hollywood hasn't told you, things that you don't know. I have had an incredible good fortune to be part of a program for the National Endowment for the Arts. I was down at Fort Carson today participating in this, called Operation Homecoming. They sent writers to military bases all over the country, and this isn't political, by the way. I don't want anybody to feel uncomfortable. It has nothing to do with politics. But they sent writers around the military bases to lead writing workshops just to get the soldiers, their spouses, families, anyone, tell your story. Tell us what it's like. Well, what are you going through? Emails, letters, journals, fiction, nonfiction, short stories, novels. 12,000 pages were submitted to this program. I was on the panel that had to narrow it down to a 500-page book. Boy, that was tough. I was at Fort Richardson, Alaska. At Anchorage, leading one program. I was in the Persian Gulf on the Carl Vinson aircraft carrier for a week. You talk about an experience, life-changing experience. I was also on a guided missile destroyer. I tailhook landed on a carrier. My heart is still, you know, somewhere up here from that one. When I was in Fort Richardson, I was asking the, much like you, a mixed group of people, and there were officers, enlisted men and spouses, and you know, men, women, young, old, and I was asking them why they had come, what their interest was, what they might want to write about, and there was one very elderly gentleman, and a civilian, and I said, sir, why are you here? Well, my wife told me I ought to come. And in his next breath, he said, I'm a survivor of Guadalcanal. As he said the word Guadalcanal, he choked up. This grizzled, crusty guy, 60 years later, that story is right there. He's probably never told the story to anyone, but it's right there. That so illustrated the point of that whole program, and it so illustrates, I think, the point of what I'm trying to do. These stories, I have a father-in-law who was in Germany with Patton. He crossed the Rhine River in the Third Army, and he was missing in action for 2 weeks. And my mother-in-law has the telegram, you know, we regret to inform you your husband is missing in action. That's a wonderful thing to have delivered to your front door. He was missing for 2 weeks. He came home with a German officer's Luger. He has never talked about how and why he has this Luger. He just won't talk about it. It is the storyteller's job to keep these stories alive, to pass them on to future generations, because sometimes the people, someone cautioned me, beware, be careful, of the guy who puts his arm around your shoulder and wants to tell you all his war stories, because there's a real good chance that that guy didn't do that stuff, because the guys who did the stuff don't want to talk about it. And I agree with that. My experience has been exactly that. And I feel very strongly that the good fortune that has fallen on me, what I'm able to do and the fact that I'm able to tell these stories and have audiences read them, there's an enormous responsibility I feel for that. First of all, get it right. Don't screw around with history. Don't put two people together who never met. Don't create a conversation that never could have happened. Don't put somebody on the ground in Sicily in a situation that did not occur. This occurred. It occurred a lot. That's what I do. I want to wrap this up because I very much would like to hear from you, but I've never talked like this without mentioning something. I mentioned The Killer Angels. I mentioned the film Gettysburg. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with that, and that some of you, maybe that's why you're here. After my father's death, my mother and I found a manuscript in his effects. It was a baseball story that he wrote about 1980, could not get it published. Baseball was not in vogue around that time. At the time of his death, we found this manuscript, and in the meantime, baseball had become hot. You had Bull Durham and Field of Dreams. Robert Redford had made The Natural. These wonderful baseball stories. Baseball was in fashion. My father was a master of bad timing. I took the manuscript to New York, got it published, and Kevin Costner made a movie out of it. It's called For Love of the Game. It came out in 1999. The book's better than the movie. But when I saw the premiere of the movie in New York, that was the second time that I have sat in a movie theater when lights go down and the credits come up on the screen and I have seen, based on the novel by Michael Shara, that my father did not live to see. I take very seriously that I am walking in enormous footsteps. If not for my father's heart disease — he was 59 when he died — if not for his heart disease, he would be standing here. These would have been his books to write. He would have gotten the call from Ted Turner saying, we want to do more movies. A little piece of trivia. Some of you may have heard me say this. Gods and Generals, the title of my first book, was the original title for The Killer Angels. It was rejected. I don't even know why it was rejected. In the 1970s, maybe putting God in the title of a book was not fashionable. I have no idea. But it was turned down. It's an original title to my father. It's not a quote from Shakespeare. It's not anything like that. My quotes generally, the last full measure, it comes from the Gettysburg Address. I like to use quotes like that. But Gods and Generals is original to my father. And so when I was about halfway through the writing of that manuscript, it was perfect. I remember that title. It exactly fit the story I was trying to tell. So regardless of what happens to me and however many books I write and what topics they're on, there is a link between me and my father that regardless of these stories and who you might consider heroes and who you might fall in love with or who you might identify with or cry when they die, there is a link that I have with Michael Shara that none of these stories will ever change. Thank you. And I very much would like to hear from you if anybody has any questions. Yes, and I'll repeat the question. Yes, sir.
Why didn't you start this book earlier?
Well, 42. Actually, the book starts in the spring of 42. That was a tough decision on my part. The question is, why didn't I start this book earlier than where it starts? One of the problems I run into, of course, with World War II, boy, is there a lot of history. There's a lot of stuff. My editor and I actually sat down and mapped it out. If we were to do the whole war, it would take 8 books. My publisher doesn't want to publish 8 books on World War II. The challenge was, okay, it's an American story, but you can't just tell an American story. It's also a British story, a German story, a French story. Eventually, it'll be a Japanese story. So it's not in a vacuum. You have to find a place, and I had to find a place. I can't start with Hitler invading Poland September 1st, 1939, because that's a whole book. Dunkirk is a book. The Battle of Britain. All this stuff happens before this book starts. Well, the nicest — I got a review, and by way of sort of answering your question, I got a review in the Wall Street Journal last Friday. It's the first time I've ever been reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. Wow, what a review. I was eating breakfast in Washington. I opened the Wall Street Journal. There's the review. It's like, do I dare read this? I was terrified. Well, what if they just cut me to pieces? I'm going to feel terrible. I started reading, and it's funny, I read one line, and then I make myself read the next line all the way through the review. One of the things this guy says, the introduction to this book should be required reading for every high school student, every history student. Because what I try to, and what a, it's a, that's an enormous compliment. I was really honored by that. But the point is, what I do in the introduction is I deal with that. I tell you why the war started, how it started, how Hitler came to power, what happens, Dunkirk, the Battle of Britain, all of these things, the invasion of Russia. I give you that story in the introduction because I had to. I can't just drop you down in the desert and say, okay, now we're going to begin. That would make no sense. So that's the purpose of the introduction in this book. And believe me, that was a tough decision. Ending this book is easy because I know right it's where the next one's going to start. You know, that's the easy part. But where to begin was a real tough decision. And I did the best job I could. I tried to make the most sense out of the beginning that where it seemed to fit the story. Yes, sir. Boy, that's the question, how do I decide what to leave out of every story because there is so much available? I mean, the challenge, for example, go back to the American Revolution. I mean, you treasure everything you can find because there's just not that much original material. I mean, I have some wonderful stuff, but there's not acres and acres of it. You get into World War II, there is tons of stuff. There are all kinds of memoirs. And, I mean, I typically read 60 to 70 books for every book that I do. But with World War II, if I wanted to read just memoirs, there's thousands of them, and I could be reading for the rest of my life. At some point, you have to stop. Well, for me, two things happen. First of all, it's not the event. It's the character. It starts with the character. I have to find the characters that draw me in, that appeal to me. Sometimes I'll go in with a preconceived notion of who the characters are going to be, and somebody doesn't work. I can't find good stuff, or the character just doesn't resonate with me. I can't put the words in his mouth, and so I move on to somebody else. In this, I mean, the character in this book of Albert Kesselring. I knew nothing about Albert Kesselring, Rommel's commander, right, his superior officer, but he's in the book. I mean, he's not a major character, but he's there. Interesting guy. I have his memoir. But the problem is, if I start including everybody that I find a memoir for, I end up with a 2,000-page book that nobody wants to read. And it's real hard, and I've already gotten criticism from a Brit in Washington who came to the book signing, a British man. How come you don't tell the story of Dunkirk? I mean, I've touched on a little bit here about what happened at Dunkirk, incredible drama. Well, that's a good point, but that's another book. And that's the problem, is like I can't do it all. None of my books, and I always say this in my letter to the reader, at the beginning of the book, none of my books are the blow-by-blow history of the entire event. My father didn't do that with Gettysburg, and he caught grief. In The Killer Angels, where's Dan Sickles? Where's Culp's Hill? None of that's in The Killer Angels. Exactly the same principle, is that you simply can't tell it all, and it's tough. I mean, there are things in the American Revolution books that I left out that great stories that I would love to put in there. But I also have an editor, and the guy's looking over my shoulder, and he says, you know, we got to keep it to a 650-page manuscript. So that, I mean, it all comes into play, but it is very, very tough deciding what to leave out. Hopefully what I end up with is a coherent story. That's really what it amounts to. Yes? Well, when you're talking, yeah, the question is, you know, there is an enemy. I mean, there's a very clearly defined enemy. Unlike, for example, the Civil War, where depending on what part of the country you're in, somebody else is the enemy. Yes, I mean, very definitely, and I talk about this. I mean, Rommel is a major character in this book, and I was very nervous about that because there are a lot of people that would condemn me for painting this three-dimensional portrait of a character who is a German. I mean, the Germans, there's no doubt. The Germans are the bad guys. The Japanese are the bad guys. I mean, and I'm not equivocating on that at all. But Rommel is a human being, and he's a three-dimensional character, and he's a good military officer, and it's a good story. And that's what I'm looking for, is a good story. So you do get, in Rommel's mind, you do get Kesselring briefly. It's one chapter from Kesselring's point of view. And I did that in the World War I book. I mean, the Red Baron is a major character in that story. You know, and he's the enemy. I mean, he's the German. But he's a fascinating character. And that's really the point. It's not about labeling. It's not about the one-dimensional stuff that Hollywood gives us. It's about finding a good story, and it starts with the characters. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
It sounds like, I've not read this one yet, but if you're World War I, you want to go against someone, bureaucracy,
that
you care about?
Now, the question is, you know, is there a bureaucracy that every soldier, basically every commander, has to deal with, and is that consistent throughout all the story? It goes all the way back to the American Revolution. George Washington being, you know, having the Continental Congress sticking their nose into Washington's campaigns or providing or not providing the money he needs to fight the war. That's been true. This is what is so wonderful about Eisenhower. It's also what's so wonderful about George Marshall, the chief of staff. Marshall's in Washington. This is the guy who's got to deal with the congressmen who are griping and complaining, or he's got to deal with Roosevelt's enemies and the newspapers and all the things. And Marshall's the filter, because he knows Eisenhower's out there and we got a job to do. And I don't like politics. I don't like to get into politics. I was on a radio show yesterday and we talked a lot about this exact point, that civilian bureaucrats or civilians in general are more prominent in a free society, a free republic like we are, compared to Germany. Germany, you know, Hitler, the generals, I mean, there was no Congress getting in the way of that. They could do exactly what they wanted to do. Joseph Stalin could do exactly what he wanted to do. Order the generals, go do this, and they would do it. In our country, in Britain, it was a little bit different. You had civilians, you had a prime minister, you have a president, you have a Congress, you have a parliament, and it's tougher. This is one of the reasons why I like Eisenhower, is he understands the dance. He understands what he has to do, and he does it. He accomplishes it. And that, maybe that's not as interesting a story as what it's like for Jesse Adams lying on his back in the moonlight in Sicily. To me it is, because it's as important to the whole story as the guy with the Thompson submachine gun. Yes, sir. Yeah, how do I narrow down to a particular kind of character or put a certain... I make that, it's a conscious choice, because, I mean, in my last book, like I said, it was a Marine, because the Marines are in the middle of everything, in Belleau Wood and these things in the First World War. It made sense to me, if I'm going to North Africa, where most of the battles are tank battles, find a tanker. And I mean, I purposely researched what it's like to sit in one of the tanks. As I said, I went to the Danville, Virginia. If you ever go to Danville, Virginia, there is a magnificent tank museum in Danville. It's impressive. German, I mean, they got everything. It's really amazing. The paratrooper, one reason I latched on to the 82nd Airborne, my father was in the 82nd Airborne. And I just thought, well, that's kind of a good thing. But also, I need somebody who's in the right place at the right time. To make this a good story, I need to put somebody, I mean, if I decided to choose a B-17 pilot, well, yeah, I mean, I could have him up there making bombing runs, but what's really going on that's interesting is on the ground. The Kasserine Pass, to tell the story from a guy at 30,000 feet doesn't make a lot of sense. Or to tell it from a guy, a British sailor on a ship. You see what I'm saying is I have to find a character who's in the place where I need him to be to move you through this story. Now, next time out, the luxury of doing a trilogy. This is the first of a trilogy. The middle part of this book is Normandy, D-Day, the centerpiece. Much like the Killer Angels was the centerpiece of the Civil War, it's convenient. I hate to use the word. History is convenient in the Second World War in the same way history was convenient in the Civil War. Gettysburg is not the final great battle. It's a major turning, not the turning point, a major turning point, and so you can do a before and an after. Normandy is exactly the same thing. It's a turning point. After the third book, the Battle of the Bulge, crossing the Rhine River, in each of these cases, the setting for the grunt is different. Instead of Africa, and instead of jumping out of airplanes, at Normandy, you got the ranger climbing up the rocks on the beach. You got the guys going inland. Battle of the Bulge, they're in the snow. You know, it's an entirely different setting. Who those characters will be, I don't know yet. I'll find them. So I will give you a variety, you know, from one book to the next of these different guys. And, of course, then when I go to the Pacific, then it's a whole different thing. There's one thread. I'll just mention this. There's one thread that ties this book to what will be the fourth book in the Pacific. There's a pilot who flies a B-17 who Eisenhower recognizes as the finest pilot in the American Air Service, and this is the guy who flies Eisenhower from England down to Gibraltar and from Gibraltar to Algiers, and he flies General Clark and all these other people back and forth because he's considered, you know, he's the best pilot. He flies a B-17 called the Red Gremlin. Well, this man doesn't stay in the Mediterranean theater very long. He goes back home. He trains in Utah to fly the new fancy state-of-the-art B-29. which is the bigger bomber, much higher altitude. Then he goes to the Pacific, to the island of Tinian. The man's name is Paul Tibbets. This is the man who flies the Enola Gay, who drops the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Well, he's in this book in a minor role, but he's there. And he will certainly be in the fourth book. And actually, Colonel Tibbets just passed away, I believe, 6 months to a year ago. It was not long ago. And he wrote a lot. He spoke a lot. It's going to be very interesting when I get to that, because he'll tie the whole thing together. So anyway, that was a little aside. So, anyone else, please? Yes, sir. The question is, how far along was I in the Korea book? I have the entire library. I have neat stuff. I have a whole entire bookshelf in my office full of Korea stuff. I have a memoir from a Chinese soldier. I have a memoir from a North Korean soldier. I have a memoir from an American who was in a North Korean POW camp. I mean, there's a point of view in a whole different, you know. Well, you know what most Americans know about Korea? MASH. With all due respect to Alan Alda and Larry Gelbart, that's one story. I think there's some others. And that's, I mean, I'm excited about that. But no, in terms of writing, I was not at the point of writing. I do all the research first. And I really would like to go to the DMZ. And I don't know if that's possible. I don't know. I mean, I could go to Seoul, but I don't know that I could actually go to Chosun, you know, to the, I mean, I don't know. I would really like to check into that. One huge disadvantage in this book, I like to go to every place. I like to walk in the footsteps of these characters. A lot of this story with Rommel takes place in Libya. Not exactly a tourist attraction. It's not a place you can just, you know, hop on a plane, you know, Delta, you know, to Benghazi. I mean, it doesn't really work. That was a shame. However, I have been to Normandy already. Normandy, how many of you have been to Normandy? I had a feeling you'd been. Normandy is, I mean, what's amazing. First of all, it's this enormous beach. I'm talking Omaha Beach now. You look out in the surf, and there's still the remains of the artificial wharf that we built. I mean, it's still there. It's incredible. There's a museum there. It's wonderful. But Normandy is the Daytona Beach of France. It's like Daytona Beach at spring break. You go to Normandy, there's tens of thousands of French people on the beach. I mean, they're in on holiday. A goodly number of them are topless. When you're trying to walk the beach at Normandy and get into the spirit of the soldiers, I'm sorry, but it's a distraction. However, to avoid the distraction, go to the, yeah, you'll be there tomorrow, right? Go to the American cemetery. 9,000 white crosses. Every one of them with a name on it, a rank, and the date the man died. Stand there. That's actually a piece of America. There's an American flag. It's American territory right there, plopped down in the middle of France. And stand there for a while, and then you can forget about all that other stuff. You get it right there. That's a place every American should go. So anyway, I got off on the side. I told you I can talk about anything. Anyone else? Yes, sir. You know, the question, what effect did Kasserine have on the way our generals, well, first of all, our generals and our planning, first of all, it cost a couple people their jobs. Lloyd Friedendahl and Orlando Ward, I mean, Eisenhower sacked them, and they were gone. They didn't do the job. It also, I mean, we went into that war with a lot of swagger. You know, we had brand spanking new trucks and brand spanking new tanks. And, you know, we were singing, you know, all the patriotic songs. We landed in North Africa. The first people we fought in North Africa were the French. That's a story most people don't realize. Our allies, well, they weren't our allies. It was the Vichy French. You know, German-occupied Paris, Vichy government, that's who controlled Algeria, Morocco, Casablanca. And when we landed there, we didn't know how much of a fight we were going to have. And we had a fight, and it was the French. But the French, that's a whole huge story of the infighting amongst the French themselves, who's loyal, who's not loyal, who's sitting on the fence to see who wins before they decide which side they want to be on. I mean, that's all true. That's what the French did. So we got past the French. Now we're facing the Germans, and the first time we face Rommel, it's at a place called Kasserine Pass in Tunisia. We get our butts handed to us. And I mean, it's a catastrophe. One of the reasons why people are always asking me, I got this question yesterday, why isn't Hollywood, why don't we know about Kasserine Pass? Why don't we know about Americans in North Africa? We never hear that because we lost. I mean, Hollywood's not going to make that movie. You're not going to want to buy a ticket. They don't think you're going to want to buy a ticket to see a movie to watch John Wayne, you know, going, oh my God, and, you know, that's not the story we want to see. But that's what happens at Kasserine. We get knocked pretty hard, a serious bloody nose, and it changes a lot of things. First of all, it puts Patton on the front lines. Patton takes over command in that area. It changed Omar Bradley. Now, there's another name. Omar Bradley. In all the stuff I read from Patton, Omar Bradley's the only man Patton respected, which is kind of interesting. He's going to be pivotal in the next book because Bradley, he's a subordinate to Patton. By the time they get to Normandy, Bradley's up here. How Patton deals with that, it's going to be real interesting. But you know, that's another aside. Sorry. Yes, sir. The question, any possibility of any more movies from the books? Well, first of all, the question that I get a lot of deals with Last Full Measure, the third Civil War book. There is no plan right now. I put it actually on my website because I was getting so many emails asking me, Civil War people, Civil War reenactors who want to be a part of it. I hear from them all the time, probably at least one or two a day. I finally put it on the website, on my one page that has movie stuff on it. And here's exactly what I say. Because of the poor box office results for Gods and Generals, Ted Turner has pulled out of financing The Last Full Measure. And someone else may yet step forward. I mean, certainly it could happen, but right now no one in Hollywood is interested. So for the time being, at least, there is no third film in the works. And I'm really sorry about that because my feeling, we could talk about Gods and Generals all night long, and you know, we may not want to do that. But in fact, what happened with Gods and Generals is it was an enormous opportunity lost because we could have done the trilogy. And it's just a shame. But I can't blame Ted Turner. He lost a bunch of money. And so he pulled out of it. So Ted could change his mind tomorrow. I mean, he's that kind of guy. But right now, there's nothing at all happening. As far as the other things, I get calls all the time. And I've learned not to get excited. Hollywood calls, you know, and it's like, oh, Hollywood's calling. No, I don't do that, because what happens is I got a call when my Mexican War book came out, Gone for Soldiers. Guy was an agent in Hollywood, and he's calling me baby. This is like, you just know this guy is sitting at his desk in Hollywood with his shirt open to here, with the gold chain, and you know, the whole, and the Rolex, the whole thing, and he's saying, I see a buddy movie. I see Clint Eastwood as Winfield Scott. I see Kevin Costner as Robert E. Lee. This is exactly what he says. And he's just gushing, and I'm, you know, listening to this on the phone. You know, this is a slam dunk. Boy, you hear that a lot in Hollywood. This is a slam dunk. Never heard from the guy again. The slam dunk sort of, you know, bounced off the rim. Well, I get a lot of that. I get calls, people, there's a group that wants to make film a miniseries out of my two books on the American Revolution. Oh, that's nice. I really appreciate that. If it happens, great. But I don't sit by the phone. Hollywood is a funny place. I mean, there's a strange thing just happened. Clint Eastwood's movie, you know, Flags of Our Fathers, people I know in Hollywood, a couple friends of mine, the inside on that movie was, this is going to be the major blockbuster of the year. This movie's going to do Titanic numbers, huge, huge blockbuster numbers. It has bombed. It's not even in the top 10 box office in the week anymore. It's only 3 weeks old. People are scratching their heads. They don't get it. The problem for that, and I have not seen the movie purposely, because if I write some of that story and I pick up a little piece of dialogue that digs itself back here and I use it later, that's plagiarism. And I get in serious trouble for that. So I stay away from things that are the same thing I'm writing about. But the problem with that is the way Hollywood thinks, this sort of jump on the bandwagon thought process. Well, we can't make any more World War II movies. They don't make money. That's exactly what they think. So unfortunately, by that movie tanking, the chances of anything else getting done on World War II for a long time probably right out the window. So, yeah, video games. Yeah. Yes. The question is whether or not public being receptive to war movies, if it's affected by Iraq. I mean, if you look back, the only time I think that I can tell, I mean, I don't know the answer to your question, but the only time I know it was a perceptible difference was in the 70s, after Vietnam. when war movies were very much out of fashion, and it took, I mean, and then when they started making them, Coming Home, well, that wasn't a war movie, that was an anti-war movie. And, you know, The Deer Hunter, who are the enemies in The Deer Hunter? It's not us and the Viet Cong, it's the two lieutenants, Tom Berenger and Willem Dafoe. Those are the enemies, they're fighting each other. Apocalypse Now, who's the enemy? Marlon Brando, the American colonel. You know, it's not the Vietnamese. I mean, so war movies change radically in the 70s. Even Westerns, Little Big Man, Dustin Hoffman, who's the enemy? The U.S. Cavalry. You know, now, what would John Wayne say about that? I mean, but it was a whole cultural shift in this country where war movies completely changed in the 70s. The last one that was probably celebrated the Army, or two, or Patton certainly was one, and maybe Green Berets, which now you look back on and it's sort of a joke. It's so bad. The sun sets in the east at the end of the movie. I mean, that one's like, yeah. I mean, they're off the coast of Vietnam, which faces east, and they're looking into the sunset. And someone said, actually, I saw a quote, "Whatever you say, Duke." You know, so. But I don't know. I don't know how to answer your question. I don't know how this will affect, because first of all, it's still going on. I mean, the history's not done yet. So, yes. Yeah. The question is, I mean, do we perceive how what soldiers really want and what they feel differently by watching the news than really what's going on in the field? Absolutely, and that's true in every war that's ever been fought. Eisenhower, fortunately for Eisenhower, had much greater control of the flow of information back to the States. Well, the good news for Eisenhower is he could keep his plans secret, you know, so the Germans aren't going to find out when and where we're going to do something. The bad news is the newspaper reporters are sitting around with nothing to do. So what do? They make stuff up. And they start telling, you know, glory, some hometown hero, you know, suddenly some, you know, sergeant, somebody is over there and his mother, you know, whatever, and starts talking to the newspaper. Suddenly stories start appearing. I mean, it doesn't really affect the war, but it affects the home front. People are reading this stuff. That happened in the First World War. I mean, the Lafayette Escadrille was blown up into this huge propaganda machine by the American press, you know, all the local heroes and all this stuff. I mean, it's happened everywhere. And, is it a bad thing or a good thing? It just is. It's just simply the way it is. And that's one reason why, and I put in the pitch for this Operation Homecoming. The book is available. It's, you know, if they don't have it here, get it, you know, somewhere. But that book is, that's the voices of the soldiers. And not just, you got it? Hey, there we go, right there. I mean, it's not just the voices of the guy out there with the bullets whizzing over. It's from every perspective you can imagine, and there is some gut-busting stuff in there, and just amazing, amazing stuff, and some fabulous writing. So anyway, no more commercials. But anyone else? I saw another hand. Somebody? No? Well, listen, thank you all. You've been very patient. I'm going to sit up here and sign some books. Thank you very much for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Les Claypool, Jerry Spence, Jim Lehrer, Nick Bantock, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on November 15th, 2006.